The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England.
World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Hello there.
Hi.
Are you Bob Fogg?
I'm Bob Fogg.
Very nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
I was told I should be on time to meet you.
Yeah, because I am Father Time, they call me.
A little more than 1.3 million people live in New Hampshire. We're scattered over 9,000 plus square miles of trees and mountains and lakes, a little bit of seacoast, and many small towns. Places where the buildings on Main Street can look pretty much as they did 50, even 100 years ago. I met Bob Fogg in one of those villages over Labor Day weekend.
And when I started doing it, I could run up there and wind the clock and not even break a sweat or not even be breathing hard, but as the years went by, it got harder and harder. I would take a break before I'd even start to wind the clock because it was hard work.
Bob kept the town of Hancock running on schedule for 50 years, and now his son has taken over for him as agent of the clock, climbing the meeting house tower and winding the gears on the 19th century clock twice a week.
And the funny thing is my son goes down to the store every morning, has coffee with the guys. And he, at 8 o'clock, you hear the clock strike, and he'll look at his watch. He's got an atomic watch, too. And he'll look at it and says, "Oh, that's not acceptable to my father. I got to come down and fix it if it's too far off." Because he knows, he said, my father wouldn't like that.
Hancock is one of those white clapboard villages tucked into the Monadnock region. The town clock tower presides over the common, ringing on the hour for everyone below, except for those who aren't in any hurry.
That faces a cemetery, and those people do not care about time. And I tell that to everybody. I says, time means nothing to those people out there. Their time is not, they're past their time. So there's no clock face in toward the north, which is the cemetery.
Despite outward appearances, time is marching on in Hancock. Bob retired from caring for the 150-year-old clock. But like many people, he wonders about whether technology is changing, even threatening aspects of small-town life. Locals can now stay in touch with far-flung family and friends without leaving home. Town papers have consolidated or have shut down. New businesses can survive in a global market without catering to their neighbors.
It'll probably come a time when they have a digital clock up there. I hope they don't, but I like the quaintness of the old clock. But the way modern technology is, someday they'll probably have a big digital clock up there like you wear on your wrist showing the time.
Long ago, townsfolk stopped depending on the chiming bell to get them to the church or the railway station on time, but they depended on Bob to keep it running. A few years after he started, town leaders stopped asking if he'd like to take the job again. They just assumed that he would. Villages can seem to run on habits and tradition, but behind all those spoken and unspoken gestures are the people who keep them alive.
And I told him, I said, well, you know, I would really wind the clock for nothing. I didn't do it for the money. I did it because I love the town of Hancock, and I like to see something. Because people go by, and they automatically look up at the clock to see what time it is. And I enjoy doing that, too. So I told the Board of Selectmen, I said, I would wind it for nothing. But it's been quite an interesting job. And now my son has it. And he's, like I said, he's not going to do it for 50 years. He's not going to break my record. My record is safe. At least I think so.
Today we're exploring varieties of life in New Hampshire's small towns. Places you can live in for decades, yet never really be from. Where stories shared at the hardware store or meat counter might as well be published. Producer Molly Donahue gets things rolling with a visit to a village.
All over New Hampshire, towns are divided into even smaller communities. Barnstead contains Center Barnstead, Barnstead Parade, and South Barnstead. In Tamworth, you'll find Chicora, South Tamworth, Wanalancet, and Whittier. And Suncook straddles the line between Allenstown and Pembroke. But there it is, in its unincorporated glory. The more you look, the more you realize. New Hampshire towns are riddled with little villages. That's the issue at the center of an Only in New Hampshire question we received. Why are so many towns split up this way? To get a better understanding of how this came to be, I hopped into the car and made the trek up to Grafton to talk to someone in the know.
So my name is Andrew Cushing. I work for the New Hampshire Preservation Alliance. I'm the field service representative, which means that I travel the state and meet with communities concerned about saving old buildings.
Andrew's from Grafton, and he knows the town pretty well. And there's actually a small detail here that really gives him an advantage.
So I have to confess, so my father wrote the history book for the town of Grafton.
Having a father who wrote the official history of your hometown would give anyone a leg up in the historical society. And it also makes Andrew an ideal guide to help explain Grafton's layout. Because looking at a map of the town, it gets confusing, fast. There's the whole town itself, which is named Grafton, but when you take a closer look, you'll realize it's split into several different parts. There's Grafton Center, then a few inches away, about 3 miles according to the scale, is Grafton Village, and a few inches after that is East Grafton. I spent the afternoon with Andrew to get a better understanding of why there are three smaller Graftons all within town limits. But when we first headed up Turnpike Road, we didn't head towards any of them. We headed up a hill to where the whole show started back in 1785.
In 1785, the Baptists, who were really good at proselytizing to the peripheral towns folk, so they would try to create congregations in the wilderness, trying to kind of duke it out with the Congregationalists to get power in some of these rural towns.
When the Baptists arrived in the 1780s, they built Grafton's first meeting house up on Razor Hill. Two taverns hugged the meeting house, and Razor Hill was the center of town life. Until it wasn't. Only 12 years after the meeting house had been built, those Congregationalists Andrew mentioned earlier, they got the upper hand.
So we're on Razor Hill in Grafton. Grafton Center came a little later. But Grafton Center came about because while the Baptists claimed this spot, most people in town said, wait a second, this isn't the exact center of town. We want to build another meeting house.
So that's what they did. In 1797, the townspeople, led by the Congregationalists, started coming down off the mountain, and they built a new meeting house in the geographic center of Grafton, which is why the village that eventually grew up around it became known as Center Grafton. So that's where we headed next.
We just pulled into Grafton Center, which is kind of the, from a macro view, the iconic New England village. You have the church at the head of the common, and it's ringed by all of these houses that were probably built between late 1700s and early 1800s. And a war memorial in the middle, and hill surrounded by hills.
Center Grafton was established because of religious differences and sheer geography, and that's one reason towns can get split up into separate villages. But another big reason? The railroads. 50 years after Center Grafton was settled, the Northern Railroad came through and connected the whole town to the rest of the world, a shift that was happening all over New Hampshire. And that's when things really changed for people living in Center Grafton.
And this is kind of the story of New Hampshire. When the railroad came through, the economic and religious and social centers of all towns shifted to where the railroads built their depots.
A quick refresher. Railroads revolutionized life in America, not just out west, but in places like Grafton, too. Depots cropped up every 3 miles or so, establishing stores, boarding houses, and industry in places that used to be in the middle of nowhere. Which gets us to the next spot on our map. About 3 miles east of Grafton Center, down Route 4, you come across Grafton Village. This is where you can find the Grafton Country Store, the post office, library, and former Grafton Inn. In its heyday, Grafton Village had the largest side rail on the Northern Railroad, which meant a pretty large and active freight yard. And aside from infrastructure, the railroad put new places on the map, literally.
Because railroads needed to have special names for their depots to avoid confusion on like data logs or schedules, it kind of made concrete those village names and those village identities that we now see today.
Even though railroads made a huge impact on places like Grafton Center and Grafton Village, they weren't the only source of industry, and the communities that formed around them. We got back into the car and continued further down Route 4 before making a left turn back onto Turnpike Road to get to our final place on the map, East Grafton. East Grafton didn't have a railroad depot. It's sitting back towards the hills, but it does have another resource. Mill Brook runs through East Grafton and powered the mills that used to sit along its banks. Most of those buildings are gone now, but the old carding mill is still standing, and it's a perfect example of Grafton at its prime.
Built in 1823, And this was an operation through the 1920s, and it's just a small 2.5-story wood frame building, timber frame building. And at its peak, it employed 25 people who worked here 12 months out of the year.
And all that industry and money coming into a place like East Grafton helped turn it into a little village all its own.
Really, by 1900, you have shingles being made here, you have clapboards, you have bobbins, you have boxes, you have, I already said shingles, but you have coffins and carded material, so like yarn and wool and flax. You have cider being pressed, so it was really an industrial hub.
Another popular product coming out of Grafton at the time were bungs, stoppers for barrels. After an accident involving a cartload of them, East Grafton took on the name Bungtown, a name that might be making a comeback if Andrew has anything to do with it.
Probably thanks to all the neighbors, I got the historic marker here earlier this year, and so the name is now back in our, back in view.
I know.
It does smell like Christmas in here from that wreath.
Yeah.
Grafton, the town as a whole, I mean, is still small. Our ringing the bell at the East Grafton Meeting House didn't quite bring people running.
It's very impressive.
It is.
But Andrew did tell me he later got a lot of questions around town about who he had been talking to. The population is back around 1,200 people, roughly the same it was at population peak in the 1850s. But that's after dipping to around 300 in 1970. People don't really have a reason to distinguish between villages anymore, since the railroad has stopped running and the mills have shuttered. The main thing all the villages of Grafton have going for them now? The highway. Which means that people don't have to live right next to the place they work and the place they worship. So, the story of New Hampshire's villages, at least up in the old industrial towns, seems to sit with transportation and changing technology. But when it comes down to it, a village is just a place. Somewhere that was once a community within a town, with a separate identity, neighbors that knew each other, maybe a general store and a library. Just people, establishing a sense of place. For Only in New Hampshire, this is Molly Donahue.
Villages may be physical reminders of New England history, but what is their legal status? Can they provide utilities or have their own governments? According to former Portsmouth Town Attorney Peter Laughlin, sometimes, but not always.
I suspect for every little center and for every village district, there's a separate story.
Municipal law is a little thin here, but in order to become a legally recognized entity, a group of citizens would petition the legislature to have a village district formed. And then it would go to a local vote.
At some point, a group of citizens decided that they would be better served if they had a separate defined governmental entity.
New Hampshire has a legal definition of a village district, and the classification had practical origins. In the 1840s, the first village districts formed as fire districts, and some of them still are, but that is not always the case.
Over the years, the powers of village districts or the things that they can do have expanded so that there are probably a dozen or so things that village districts can do now. A lot of them now are provide water service or fire service or wastewater treatment.
In places like Hampton and Rye, village districts tended to protect the interests and the flower beds of wealthy enclaves.
Northampton and Rye both started their districts around 1895, and it was to provide lighting and shade trees, and that would be the wealthiest part of each of those communities.
Those villages along the seacoast wanted services that weren't being provided to the general communities. So if some towns are actually composed of small, separate villages, each with its own forms of government, what about those places, often north of the Notches, that don't appear to have any government at all? Producer Hannah McCarthy investigated and explained what she found to NHPR's Rebecca Lavoie.
So, Rebecca, you asked a question about New Hampshire's hinterlands.
Actually, they're called unincorporated places.
Yeah, right. So what did you want to know exactly?
I think my question, as I worded it, was, what's up with unincorporated towns? Can you break the law there and not get into trouble? And who organizes things in these towns?
Yes. Okay. So to get to the bottom of this, I decided to go to what I'm going to call the Mac Daddy of unincorporated places in New Hampshire. So that's Coos County. So there are 25 unincorporated places in the state, according to nh.gov, and 23 of those are in Coos County.
Right.
So if you look at a map, it's like a fourth of that county is just unincorporated, like, wildling land.
North of the wall.
Exactly. So I hate to disappoint you, but I'm going to start right off the bat with the fact that basically they're not the perfect place for the perfect crime.
Oh.
No. You cannot break the law.
This is Jennifer Fish with Coos County.
The unincorporated places are governed by the state police and also some local police departments and the sheriff's department. So, you know, you can't break the law there, and you can get pulled over for speeding and anything like that.
Well, that's kind of a bummer, but to be honest, I did kind of figure that that was probably the case. We probably would have heard about it if you could just commit a murder there and not get arrested. But it doesn't really answer my question of, who is in charge of these towns? Who is running them?
In the unincorporated places, it's the county government that oversees the organization of those places. So it's basically the three county commissioners are the selectmen for those unincorporated places.
They oversee the budget, approve timber taxes.
The county also has a planning board for the unincorporated places that meets on a monthly basis.
All right, but what about day-to-day stuff? What about stuff like water and trash collection and sewers and stuff like that that you would expect to get from your town?
Yeah, so that is the one thing about unincorporated places. They have to get all of these services because they don't have any of their own. You know, dump access police, firefighters, ambulances, schools from nearby towns, from their neighbors. So the county collects this fee from the homeowners in these places, and that money goes to whatever town lets the people in, like, Hale's location use their dump.
So does it make it expensive to live in one of these towns?
Actually, it can end up working out pretty well for the homeowners because that fee that they're paying to the county is based on, like, usage estimates and how many kids are going to public school in a given year from that place. So when they've got a population of, like, three dozen retired people.
Some of those places, because there are so few people and they receive timber taxes, their revenues may exceed their expenses. So some taxpayers in unincorporated places don't pay property tax.
Actually, my mind is blown by that because, as you know, property taxes are really high in New Hampshire because of the way our whole education funding system works. People complain about them a lot in small towns. So it sounds like these places are like tax havens. It's sort of like the dream in New Hampshire. You get to live somewhere and not pay property tax. Kind of a sweet deal.
Well, so it can be. But there is this one story where things get a little wacky. Do you have a little more time to dig a little deeper on this?
Heck yeah, I do.
Okay, cool.
Just recently, within the last year, there was an article in the local newspaper here that the residents of Millsfield, the unincorporated place of Millsfield, mm-hmm. was looking to incorporate.
So a few years ago, Millsfield got kind of spooked. And it's a complicated and kind of controversial story, but there was this moment when the people in Millsfield thought that they were going to have to pay these absurdly high property taxes to kind of make up for the value of this wind farm that was built on their turf.
How could something like that happen?
Yeah, well, so I think that's what the people in Millsfield were thinking. It was like this reality check for them. And then in the end, the state passed legislation and that, you know, property tax disaster didn't actually happen. But the whole thing caused some really bad blood between the county and the unincorporated place that the county was in charge of. And it got these Millsfielders thinking that they might want to take control of their own destiny.
So the Millsfielders may want to become a real town?
Yeah.
Hmm.
I talked to Tom Claflin, who's a resident of Millsfield, and he explained that they are looking into it.
So what? They just say they want to be a town and they're a town? Like, what do they have to do to be a town?
So it's really complicated. And I think, you know, it revealed itself to be way more complicated than even the people of Millsfield thought. So it'll ultimately take passing a bill in the legislature where they say, okay, you are now an incorporated town. But becoming a municipality also means setting up a school board, a planning board, a fire department, a police department, and you have to build a physical town hall, and then you have to staff that town hall with clerks. So it's a lot of work and a lot of money, and it takes a lot of people.
Right. And I'm also thinking, like, you have to get on maps. So that's a whole other process there. You have to get in, like, the geolocating stuff. You have to, like, become a place that is called a different thing. So I guess what I'm wondering is, it seems like a lot of work, and then they'll be stuck with a huge amount of responsibility. Is it even worth it?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's like a crazy metamorphosis, and there are a lot of growing pains to it. So Tom told me that they aren't really sure yet. They're going to take their time on this one. So stay tuned. Millsfield might like fall off the list of unincorporated places in a couple of years.
Huh. Well, it's a very cool answer, very complete. I'm disappointed about not being able to commit a murder and getting away with it in any of these places. But it is way more than I ever thought I would get to know about these unincorporated New Hampshire places. Thank you.
Well, my pleasure. You're welcome, Rebecca.
Producer Hannah McCarthy investigated that question, and our exploration of small town life continues after the break. I'll speak with author Howard Mansfield about Summer Over Autumn. That's his new collection of essays and observations of ordinary life in a New Hampshire village, when word of mouth continues. Welcome back. I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is Word of Mouth. Your questions answered, your state explored. Today, we've turned up some eccentric historical clues about the state's singular village squares and remote, unincorporated towns. Now to a much more subjective topic, village life. Small-town pettiness and cruelty have been a mainstay of fiction, from Jane Austen's drawing room comedies to Shirley Jackson's The Lottery. The cruelest thing Howard Mansfield has discovered since he and his wife, author and naturalist Cy Montgomery, moved to Hancock, New Hampshire some 30 years ago, is invasive rose bushes. Since then, he's been observing and writing about the everyday encounters, shared rituals, and relationships that make small-town life distinct. It was Howard who introduced me to Bob Fogg, the man we heard from earlier, who wound Hancock's town clock for 50 years. Bob is one of the extraordinary, ordinary people profiled in Howard's new collection of essays called Summer Over Autumn. And let's be clear, Howard is not pro-quaint. His Hancock is no Mayberry RFD, but there is plenty of generosity and grace and humor, even under the rough parts. After visiting the town square, I sat down with Howard under a shady tree at the farm he and Cy share. It was a beautiful day, and the chickens were out pecking at the ground, and a couple of leaves had fallen. A perfect day to talk about Summer Over Autumn. In the book, there are a number of people like Bob Fogg who would never consider themselves doing community service. They just do what needs to be done. They pitch in. They pay attention to what's going on in the town and give their time generously. I asked Howard if he discovered what it is that motivates people to do that.
Bob Fogg winding the clock is just emblematic of all the other clocks in town that volunteers keep going. You know, the volunteer firemen, the volunteers at the library, people on all these endless committees. Just people who do the things that need to be done just about invisibly, and people who surprise us with the grace of the ordinary. It's not a routine. It's more a devotion, and it's done very quietly, and they're not the people you often see up in front of town meeting or even around town. They're very quiet about doing it.
You actually did run for a position in your town government at one point. I believe it was library trustee, the critical position of a library trustee.
I did serve as library trustee for 12 years. I used the library a lot. I'm a kind of a serial interlibrary loan user with all sorts of bizarre requests. I was willing to do that. And it was, usually you'd run unopposed, and that's not what happened in that case. There was an actual race, such as I haven't had since I think I ran for homeroom rep in what was then junior high school. And I staked out the high ground by not saying anything and not appearing in town and sort of just doing the, I think it was McKinley front porch campaign. And he ran around town like a young flatlander and he lost.
Your essays, I think, in this book dig below the surface of what we see in small towns, and not in an ungenerous way at all. So there's this line between the public life and the private life, the one that is lived behind those lit windows and the ones where other people come and visit. And
you get a couple of opportunities to go and visit people in their homes. What kind of things did you see?
Yeah, what I'm trying to get at in Summer Over Autumn are these just moments that we all live together but often just go past us without thinking about, because these days we're living in a pinball machine of social media. You know, we're just like racketing around and around. But all around us, wherever you live, are these quiet moments. Is a chance to be a tourist of the near and hand. Is a way to turn and look at something maybe you've driven past 100 times, 1,000 times, and actually see it afresh. Is a chance to remind yourself to just pause when you're off on some errand or some route and just wait and just talk to your neighbor. And I think those moments are what the book's about. And the title, Summer Over Autumn, is about just that time of year when you look up, maybe in the side of a hill or a mountain, and you see the color starting to slip out from the green is weakening, and it's like mid-August sometimes, and you realize, oh my God, the nights are cooler, neighbors have a lot of tomatoes, there's great corn, and summer's over. And it's like that, it's so poignant, it's a doorway we walk through. We're surprised that it's mundane, but there is, you know, that's why it's mundane, it's because we live it every day.
Well, you write in the book about we are all camping here. There's this sense of the temporary, and there's the sense of a permanent. And I think especially in a small town, we think this is how it is. This has been here forever. People think of a village as a finished work. What do you mean by camping here?
It's all impermanent. It's all temporary. We're here, whether you're here forever, or even if your family's been here for 6 generations, it's still temporary for you. And even if you live in a house from 1789 and you kind of adopt that as part of your permanence, you're still just like a momentary episode in the history of that house even. And the same thing for the town. The town is kind of something we hand off from person to person to person when the town works. And you go through places that stop working, it's because that kind of, almost that relay race, that baton has been dropped and someone has to go back there and pick it up and restart it. So that's sort of what's beautiful about it. It's that it's passing all the time. And it's also that's what's painful about it too.
So, you know, you came here as a writer. You were still filing, I think, for some magazines in New York City. And what was your first experience touching down in New Hampshire?
So the first night, we moved into a small town. We only got a place to rent by actually going to the newspaper after someone had dropped off a classified ad before it ran, because we knew someone at the newspaper. And I walked around town, and they had this small museum, the size of a brick building, about the size of a two-car garage. Only open in the summer, no heat. And I walked in, and it was like a musty, cool, and it was kind of disheveled. And they had these old handwritten labels in that perfect, like, I guess they call it Palmer cursive script. Mm-hmm. And it had faded, too. And I'm just looking at the shelves, and it said, tassel from the funeral car of the late President Lincoln. I go, the late President Lincoln? This was written not long after his death. I just walked out into the twilight. I was just a little bit changed. I was like, the late President Lincoln. Because here was a town in the moment of memory, deciding who are we going to commemorate, who gets to enter essentially the memory house, who gets the monuments, the names on the landscape, the holidays. So that really struck me. So I was really struck very quickly by how long people in these towns would remember things. And that seemed to be a very anti-modern kind of quality. And so I never intended to write about New Hampshire. I didn't come up here to write about it. I was still writing for these very flashy, zippity-doo-dah architecture magazines in New York, and whatever the cool part of the town was at the time, whatever the cool graphic thing was, they were laid out that way. So I just started looking, you know, going to different town meetings and reading up about Franklin Pearson, reading roadside markets, and it just kind of captivated me in the way that the past and the present are separate and at times they run together. How you can have the direct democracy of town meeting and the mass malaise of our current society. You can have the interstate and the dirt road. And one doesn't cancel out the other. They all live together. All those kind of times mingle, just as the way people are sitting behind in their house from 1820 by the wood stove, you know, streaming movies, you know. And New Hampshire is that kind of mix. And just when you think history doesn't matter, it kind of just stands up and speaks eloquently and right to the point, and people go, whoa, yeah, I guess that does still apply.
How about the idea that is the seed of provincialism, that it's hanging on to some kind of memory, some kind of story that it used to tell about itself? Is that in any way hobbling the path of villages to live in this parallel universe of the modern and the old ways?
It's a very tricky thing, I think. I mean, there's no good one answer for that. Sometimes things are just done because we've done and done them and done them, and sometimes they should be dropped, and sometimes other things should be revived that are old. You know, it's just a mix.
We keep winding the clock.
Yeah, the clock. Now that clock's a great example. That the gears and the escapement and also that is the 19th century almost. You know, that's the way so many things worked. And then you look around town, okay, there's somebody there getting the annual music festival. Oh, someone's got the old home day parade again going. So it's this constant reinvestment in community. And it's constantly people saying, yeah, this is important. And any hour of any day when people were doing some of these things, which took a lot of meetings and a lot of time, they could have been home doing what the heck they wanted. They could have been traveling. They could have been doing anything else. So I think that is really good, that you can directly get in and do something and take care of things. And it does matter whether you show up or not. And there are times we say, I just don't want to. And then the outcome is maybe not as you kind of wanted it. And you're thinking, oops, maybe I should have showed up. But, I mean, I've talked about us, living in this pinball machine of social media. I mean, I'm completely guilty of that. My head's always in my laptop. I'm all documents. Is that life? I mean, that has become life for us, but real life is not really that.
There are people that I know who talk about, New Hampshire as a brand, maybe have lived here or have moved here, and they say, why doesn't New Hampshire sell itself better? Why doesn't it do a better job positioning itself in the new economy as a place to go? You're smiting your forehead practically, Howard.
I understand the people who talk about that. I understand we have to attract industry. We have to get people to visit. But all this brand talk, it's kind of reductionist. I mean, it's not a brand, it's a place. It's an idea. We live in an idea of New Hampshire as much as we live in New Hampshire itself. I mean, look where we're living. We are living in a state named for a county in England. So when everybody says we should have a brand, they're trying to get everything nicely packaged and theme parked. Now, Vermont, this is not my opinion, but Vermont marketing consultants will tell you, is a stronger brand as Coke and Disney. And if they come see our leaves turning, they're a little disappointed because they didn't see Vermont's leaves turning. In one of my other books I wrote about, a guy walks into our general store there in the middle of town and says to Pat Higgins, who was then at the cash register, do you have Vermont maple syrup? And she says, we have New Hampshire maple syrup, pointing to rows and rows of Bill Eva's maple syrup sitting right there. And he goes, don't you have Vermont maple syrup? And Pat Higgins says to him, don't you know where you are? And that's the question.
Today, Bob Fogg brought us up in the tower above the town meeting place in the South Congregational Church. It's just beautiful. You look around, it really does look like a sort of picture postcard. Isn't there a danger, though, or I guess an old tradition of writing about small towns and sounding either snippy or quaint? How'd you walk that line? Or is that something that you were thinking about?
It's funny, we as soon as you tell somebody you've written about small towns, they raise their eyebrows and think, and they're expecting the whole parade of hypocrisy from the books that we read in school about the small village life in the 1920s, Spoon River Anthology. There's a whole bunch of them. I mean, everything's always rotten in the town. And we're kind of geared to look for that. But basically, people could be miserable anywhere. So that's not the case. I'm not nostalgic. I've never really been nostalgic. I think we can appreciate the charm and the beauty of these places, and I think they have important lessons to teach us about proportion, balance, building at last. And that's the way I approach it. I mean, to me, it's a tradition that teaches.
So there is this story at the end of the book when you're talking about, what was the name of the chapter, Coming to New Hampshire?
This is the chapter just about what I've learned, I guess, in the last 30-some-odd years of living here. And I talk about just the way we solve things in New Hampshire. I think of New Hampshire as a crooked path, and the crooked path always turns out to be the most direct route. This is how things really work in small towns. People get together, figure things out, and walk the crooked path to a solution. One woman I know told me about how she used to help an old neighbor. He had all sorts of problems, she said. He was quite ill. I used to pick up his urine sample every morning and take it to the hospital, she said, and added that you can't do that anymore, just waltz in with your neighbor's piss. There has to be a chain of custody. But back then, you just did what needed to be done. This is not a heartwarming story. Norman Rockwell would never paint a picture of the urine pickup, and you won't find it in our town. But it's New Hampshire's story. It looks directly at the unpleasant facts and takes care of them.
Yeah, so I'm guessing that the urine sample is not going to be on the tourism poster.
And yet it's about helping your neighbor out. You know, a lot of states brag about themselves as the Big Apple. All that. You never heard anyone call New Hampshire the Big Granite. You know, no, it's like it takes a perverse pride in modesty. There's that story that the late Van McLeod told. He's talking about this nationally respected glassblower, right, who lived in, I think, in up around Sandwich or up near up around Ragged Mountain. And he's telling it to one of his neighbors. That this, you know, your neighbor, he's this nationally respected glassblower. And the guy looks at him and goes, him? He can't be. He's my neighbor. That's New Hampshire. Terminal modesty. We're all just plain folks. That's it. Anyway.
And that was my visit to Hancock, New Hampshire, to speak with Howard Mansfield. His new book is called Summer Over Autumn, a small book of small town life. And that is it for today. Next week, we're going to be heading out to the seacoast to investigate another listener question.
You know, just coming here from a college town, just wondered why everything in town Portsmouth here closed so early.
Our show today was produced by Molly Donahue with Taylor Quimby, Logan Shannon, Jimmy Gutierrez, Hannah McCarthy, and Ben Henry. Maureen McMurray is Director of Innovation and Audience Development and pretty much keeps the clocks wound and the trains running on time. Music in this episode from Blue Dot Sessions, Jazar, and David Seste. I'm Virginia Prescott. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. Stay with us for Civics 101, coming up right after the break. Civics 101 is supported in part by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Who is the current Speaker of the House?
Don't even know.
Will they rule in the president's favor or will they send it to the Supreme Court?
You can't refer to a senator directly by their name.
Congressional redistricting.
Separation of power.
Executive orders.
The National Security Council.
Civics 101.
I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is Civics 101, the podcast refresher course on some of the basics that you may have forgotten or slept through in school. Today, we're going to get some help answering this question.
Hi, this is Susan from Odenton, Maryland, and my question is, what happens when a president or a governor declares a state of emergency? Both the opioid abuse crisis and the Charlottesville rally were declared states of emergency in the same week. Are there differences between the federal and state responses? Thank you.
Kim Lane Shepley is professor of sociology and public policy at Princeton. Hello, Kim.
Hello.
So what is that official process for declaring a national emergency?
Well, there are actually several processes for the president to declare national emergencies. There's one process that is regulated by a law called the National Emergencies Act, which gives him all kinds of powers in domestic law that he would not otherwise have. And that's what Donald Trump was, I think, pointing to when he sort of declared but didn't actually legally declare a state of emergency for the opioid epidemic. There's another kind of state of emergency that presidents can also declare, and that's one for international emergencies. And that's under the International Economic Emergency Protection Act. And under that act, the president can designate certain individuals and organizations for sanctions, that they can't receive certain kinds of materials or funds from the United States, for example. And the president has declared several of those in recent weeks against various foreign enemies or foreign agencies that the U.S. wants to pressure in a particular way, including, for example, some organizations and individuals who have been providing support to the North Korean government. So, if you look at states of emergency in the U.S. at any one time, there are 40, 50, 60 states of emergency going on at once. And you might be kind of confused by that because, you know, you walk down the streets and there's no tanks in the streets. Doesn't look like a country under emergency. But that's the legal label for the president to actually invoke these very special powers that he's been given by Congress.
Let's get into that a little. The power is granted to the president alone, so Congress does not have to approve or keep in check declarations of emergency?
Well, it used to be the case, if you go back far enough in American history, presidents would just declare emergencies on their own. And then after President Nixon did that a couple of times as he was facing impeachment, Congress got a little bit nervous about exactly what presidents can do, especially when investigations are closing in on them. And the president seems to have no limits on the way the president can, shall we say, hold off those kinds of investigations. So back in the 1970s, Congress developed a series of laws that actually regulate presidential emergency powers. So Congress has to give the president permission to declare an emergency of a certain type. This is how we get these two different kinds of emergencies, the national ones and then these international ones. So those are regulated under different frameworks. So it looks like Congress has kind of reined the president in, which, you know, not a bad thing if you've got an out-of-control president. The problem is the reining in is not very serious. The president, whenever he thinks it's justified, can declare a state of emergency and then use powers that Congress has scattered throughout the laws to address the crisis. And there's something like, at last count, 400 to 450 different laws, this is just at the federal level, that give the president particular kinds of powers that he can use if he actually first declares a state of emergency.
Let's go through that. Like, what gets triggered? What does it mean when a national emergency is declared? You mentioned tanks rolling. What happens?
Yeah, well, you know, we don't really usually have tanks rolling in the street during emergencies. Instead, emergency powers are used to override laws that would otherwise normally have effect. And actually, it's also used to override some constitutional provisions that would otherwise have effect. So, for example, you know, presidents all the time declare national disasters or emergencies if there are hurricanes, floods, giant snowstorms, you know, various kinds of weather-related emergencies. Earthquakes would be another example. And when the president declares emergency powers, what the president can usually do is to take money that's been allocated for other purposes and redirect it to deal with the crisis that the country's facing at the moment. Constitution 101 says that Congress must appropriate funds for specific uses. And so here you've got a case where the president sort of overrides that and takes money Congress has put aside for one purpose and uses it for another purpose. Now, you'd think that would violate the Constitution, but that's never actually been challenged before any court in the U.S. So everyone is acting like this is a perfectly constitutional arrangement, even though the main thing these emergency powers do is to redirect funds that Congress had appropriated for other purposes.
So frees up federal disaster funds or other funds for affected communities, let's say, allow federal agencies maybe to waive some rules or regulations to respond.
Absolutely.
But how about civil and constitutional rights? Can they be revoked under declarations of national emergency?
Ah, that's so interesting. So, yes, under certain laws, the president actually has the power, for example, to call out the National Guard to deal with emergencies and to deploy even some military forces. Once that happens, then, of course, you can also find with it things like curfews or preventive detention. We actually saw this with the outbreak of these various kind of diseases that come into the U.S. with U.S. carriers, and then those people are quarantined for a while. That's a different kind of emergency power where suddenly somebody's civil liberties are suspended and they have to spend time in a hospital for a while. So, yes, I mean, you can get military in the streets calling curfews. You can get different kinds of rules for stopping and searching vehicles. You can get different rules for stopping and searching individuals. So all of those things are weirdly legal under states of emergency, because what Congress has done is to provide this whole catalog of alternative legalities, so to speak, alternative legal powers that the president can invoke as long as he first says the magic words, "I declare a state of emergency."
And can they be declared indefinitely, or is there a stipulated time limit on an emergency?
There are limits. The president has at most 12 months to have a state of emergency before it has to be renewed. But it turns out to be extremely easy to renew it, and you can renew these states of emergency indefinitely. So, for example, after 9/11, George Bush declared a state of emergency. And this one, again, you have to declare the state and then list the kinds of things you're going to do. And he could have done a whole bunch of things. After 9/11, everybody was panicked and would have put up with quite a lot of emergency powers. But instead, he invoked a relatively modest set of powers that allows him to change the number of soldiers in the military, to sometimes extend their terms of duty, to sometimes refuse to allow them to retire or leave at the end of their terms if they're needed. In other words, it was a set of powers that had to do with his role as commander-in-chief. So that was declared right after 9/11. And every year since that time, the president, whoever the president is, signs the continuation of that declaration of emergency. So we're still, these are time limited, but the time limits are, shall we say, not terribly binding.
Well, we're talking about federal declarations. Let's go back to our original question, which was about also the declaration made by the Virginia Governor Terry McAuliffe on the day when white nationalist demonstrators clashed with counter-protesters in Charlottesville. So what happens when an emergency is declared in a state?
Well, this now depends on state law. So, and every state has their own law for regulating this. So let's just take Virginia, because that's where this emergency was declared for Charlottesville. There, you actually have an executive order that came out from the office of the governor. He cites this law that allows him to declare a disaster and a state of emergency. And then he says what authority he's invoking. Now, there's a different problem with the executive order for the governor of Virginia, right? So we've seen already that Trump's declaration of an emergency actually wasn't a declaration of an emergency. It was a one-sentence press release that accomplished absolutely nothing. So there is no emergency at the national level for the opioid crisis, despite what everybody reported in the press. No legal statement. In Virginia, there is a legal statement that there is a state of emergency, but it's a very long executive order. It goes on for pages and pages. In fact, it goes on for seven single-spaced pages. And it gives the governor all kinds of authorities that are not really particularly related to what happened in Charlottesville. So what it looks like to me is that they must have some kind of boilerplate. They have a generic emergency declaration sitting around that the government pulls out to sign. And that declaration isn't particularly tailored to fit the particular emergency of Charlottesville. For example, let me read you one, just one sentence. It overrides the rules that, quote, grant temporary overweight, overwidth registration or license exemptions to all carriers transporting essential emergency relief supplies. That would be relevant if you had a flood or you had some kind of other weather-related disaster, an earthquake or something. But for civil unrest, you usually don't need to transport major amounts of emergency supplies in super large trucks, right? They literally gave the governor in this, the emergency declaration, every single emergency power, I think, that he was authorized to have under state of Virginia laws, whether it was relevant or not.
Yeah, I looked at that. There are sections about transporting hazardous waste, the feeding of livestock. But I'm wondering about the optics and the symbolism of declaring a state of emergency. Is declaring a state of emergency about messaging?
Yeah, so messaging is a big part of these states of emergency. It sort of says the executive is in charge, the executive is acting, the executive is efficient in doing something. And this may put the U.S. in a very special category of countries worldwide. In most countries, when a state of emergency is declared, it doesn't make people feel better. It makes you nervous about what the government is going to do. So the fact that governors and presidents can use states of emergency to comfort people or to show that somebody is acting as they should be is really a kind of testament to the American system of government, at least up until the point where it stops working, right? So, and this is really where my concern comes in, is that emergencies are so routinely declared in the U.S., and they are so routinely used for this kind of messaging purpose where they're designed to say, you know, yes, we're handling things, that we forget that they really are exceptions to normal law. And in some cases, they really are truly extraordinary exceptions to regular law. We shouldn't be comforted by the sheer number of states of emergency that exist at any one time in the United States. Surely, if this is a routine problem, you know, you have some natural disaster and you have to get relief supplies across roads that otherwise would be closed or, you know, something of that kind, there's got to be some way we can handle that short of a generalized suspension of normal law. Because if you had a really, you know, a really major states of emergency, which is to say massive civil liberties violation, tanks in the streets, you know, all the kinds of things we associate with rogue government, for example, we wouldn't really have a way to theoretically distinguish it or to actually bring legal resources to bear to check it, because the legislatures in the states and Congress at the federal level have basically assumed that they're always going to have good governors and good presidents who will stay within the limits of the law.
Kim Lane Shepley, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Kim Lane Shepley, she's director of the program in law and public affairs at Princeton University. She's author of several articles about emergencies, including Law in a Time of Emergency and The International State of Emergency. I'm Virginia Prescott, and this episode was produced by me and Ben Henry with help from Taylor Quimby. Music from Broke for Free. And before we go today, a special note for teachers and educators and pedagogues and preceptors. Thanks to a generous grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, Civics 101 is designing materials to use in conjunction with our podcasts in the classroom. And we need your help. Visit civics101podcast.org and click on the Educators tab to complete a questionnaire, which will help guide us in this developmental phase. We'll call it a visit to the Teacher's Lounge, and we hope to see you there. Civics 101 is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.